Dig it, dig it.
The Times editorial was entitled Nightmare in the Catskills.
New York State Thruway is closed, man.
The festival was declared a disaster area.
Yeah, it's far out.
Traffic jams and drug overdoses. Don't take
the blue shortages of food and the shortages of bathroom facilities.
And stormy weather.
It was an absolute miracle that the event came off as smoothly as it did.
There is always a little bit of heaven in a disaster area.
On a mid-August weekend in 1969, an estimated 400,000 young people descended upon Bethel, New York, for an event that was billed and is still remembered as 3 days of peace, love, and music.
A 52-year-old man who was at the first Woodstock Music Festival says what happened in Rome, New York last night completely blew him away.
30 years later, an inferno of destruction became the final act of a mega-concert intended to commemorate the anniversary of Woodstock. Why did Woodstock 1999 degenerate into mayhem?
Some in the crowd set fires, overturned vehicles, and toppled sound towers.
What might the strikingly polarized climax of the anniversary festival tell us about our idealistic visions of the original?
Well, there are two things. There's history and there's historical memory. And history is what happened, and historical memory is what we think happened, and that we as both historians but also ordinary people.
Maurice Isserman is James L. Ferguson Professor of History at Hamilton College and co-author of America Divided, The Civil War of the 1960s.
The Woodstock myth is that it was at one and the same time part of the 60s. It was the product of an entire decade of challenges and changes and social values and social mores, but it stood apart from the 60s because it didn't have any of the darker aspects. Ang Lee, the director of Taking Woodstock, in an interview with Entertainment Weekly earlier this year, referred to Woodstock as the last moment of American innocence. Well, I don't think America was all that innocent in the 1960s. I mean, again, you had race riots and you had the Vietnam War. It just so happened that this particular gathering reflected all the better aspects of the 1960s, the kind of communalism and the sense of adventure and exploration and the desire to get back to the garden, to get back to a simpler way of life.
Isserman offers an explanation for Woodstock's somewhat illusionary legacy.
It's one of those quirks of historical memory that Woodstock comes down to us as this kind of transcendently wonderful event. It could have been remembered as Nightmare in the Catskills if the different emphasis had come to the fore, if they'd only talked about the drug overdoses, one person was killed. So historical memory is selective. Historical memory brings certain things to the fore and tends to forget about other things. So it reflects our kind of present-day concerns and anxieties that we tend to look back and latch on to certain moments of history as a greater, more fulfilling time than our own.
Let's welcome Mr. Richie Havens.
Tom Starr is a former longtime rock radio personality and programmer who was 17 years old when he attended Woodstock in 1969.
My sister, after promising my parents she would look after me, we got there as Richie Havens started playing on the first afternoon. And she said, okay, I'm going to go get us something to eat and go to the bathroom, and I'll be back. Well, when I saw her 3 days later, and she wasn't dumping me either. She was horrified. She'd actually gone back to the car to wait for me and missed 2 days of it because she was thinking I'd go back there, but I didn't.
It was a pain in the rear end to get to.
Maurice Isserman.
We drove up Friday night, and fortunately, the New York State Thruway was closed Saturday morning, so we were probably among the last to get in, and we made it into Bethel, but still a couple of miles away from the festival grounds when we sort of kind of pulled over into a meadow where other cars were parked. Who knows whether that was legal or not. And we camped out for the night. It rained, so by the morning we were famously already wet and muddy like everybody else. And we walked in the last 2 miles to the festival, and it was just this unending stream of youthful humanity who were making their way. You kind of felt like you were part of the children's army or something. And then, of course, we had tickets. We were expecting to be going into this well-organized, slick operation, and you know, all we saw was a trampled-down fence and nobody there to collect our tickets. You walked through some woods and you kind of came out to the field and you crested the hilltop to look down on this natural amphitheater on Max Yasgur's farm that ended in the stage and the lake behind that. And my jaw dropping as we got, I mean, there were a lot of people walking in, but to see suddenly 200,000-400,000 people arrayed on this hillside was mind-boggling, mind-blowing, as we might have said at the time. It was very impressive.
This is one thing that I was going to wait a while before we talked about. Maybe we'll talk about it now so you can think about it. It's a free concert from now on. That doesn't mean that anything goes. What that means is we're going to put the music up here for free. What it means is that the people who are backing this thing, who put up the money for it, are going to take a bit of a bath, a big bath.
I think that there was a good deal of community sense about the process.
Tom Starr.
And an understanding, I think, on the part of a lot of people there that clearly it was evident right from the start that they didn't have the scene as together as they would need it to be. And the only way it was going to continue to be a good scene was if everybody was as accommodating of one another as they could be and as peaceful as they could be and made the best of it.
As I've said to many people, as this title just about puts it all into focus. It's called With a Little Help from My Friends. Remember it.
It wasn't entirely a hippie trippy crowd. I mean, I went up with a bunch of high school friends. I don't think any of them, apart from myself and my girlfriend, would have described ourselves as hippies or protesters or you know, any of the 60s stereotypes. They were just music lovers and wanted to hear the big bands. So there were all kinds of people there.
For those who did go, most of them went with a fairly good idea of what they were getting into. And they were of the right mindset to get through all of the adversity that Mother Nature threw and the shortages of food and the shortages of bathroom facilities. Portable toilets were just completely overwhelmed.
Hey, if you think really hard, maybe we can stop this rain!
The thing about the original Woodstock was that it was not very well organized.
Maurice Isserman.
There was a homemade quality to it. It was like, you know, Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney in one of those 30s movies saying, let's put on a show, kids. It was obvious to everyone that this thing was not very well run, and it sort of instilled a desire to make it work.
What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000. Now, it's not going to be steak and eggs or anything, but it's going to be good food, and we're going to get it to you.
It's a new dawn.
And one of the reasons why Woodstock worked as well as it did was because of its location. I mean, you were on Max Yasgur's farm, it's 600 acres, and you were surrounded by this beautiful Catskills countryside. There was a real anti-modernism in the 60s counterculture, a desire to sort of to get back to the garden. Despite you know, the anti-war songs, this was not a protest. It wasn't a confrontation.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
There was no politics to Woodstock beyond you know, 3 days of peace and love in the countryside.
I'm a farmer. This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place. But I think you people have proven something to the world that 500,000 kids can get together and have 3 days of fun and music and have nothing but fun and music. And I got lots of fun.
Tom Starr.
I didn't see any evidence at any point of any kind of altercation, any kind of aggressiveness, any kind of anything. And that unfortunately, really became the branding that the subsequent event ended up with.
There was a different feel to it. It was the woods and the lake and the cows, and Max Yasgur coming out and talking to the crowd had a very kind of calming effect. And I think that made everyone a little more mellow than at a place like Altamont, where the Rolling Stones played, and famously Hell's Angels killed one of the concert goers. Or one could argue at a place like a Strategic Air Command base in Rome, New York, 30 years later.
This is not your parents' Woodstock.
3 days, man, 3 days. We just love you.
The weekend of July 23rd, Rome, New York.
Okay, so come on down off the towers.
Woodstock 99, the 30th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair.
We must be in heaven, man.
The ticket goes on sale nationwide Sunday, April 25th at 9 a.m.
This feels like deja vu all over again.
As it turned out, Woodstock 1999 was indeed not your parents' Woodstock. But in the weeks leading up to the festival, local young people like Sean Saltz did hope for a sense of deja vu.
I just remember how excited everybody was and the sense of pride that started going through the community, thinking that, hey, we can be a part of history here. We're going to host a historical event.
The name Woodstock drew you in.
Christy Clifford lives in Utica, a few miles from the concert site.
You wanted to be a part of Woodstock because, I mean, for me, growing up all my life, all I heard about was Woodstock 69, Woodstock, Woodstock, Woodstock.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Phil Stern Show here on News Radio 950 WIBX. I am Phil Stern, your host, taking your calls this afternoon.
Enthusiasm for the event was not universal.
The detractors of Woodstock have had some good points to make. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, the detractors may turn out to be correct. For all we know, this could be the disaster that a lot of people are predicting.
I think we're heading into one of the worst man-made disasters we're ever going to run into.
Local concerns over the effects of a predicted 250,000 concertgoers flooding into the small upstate New York city left Woodstock 1999's fate in question until mere days before the event.
The show will go on, so says county and Woodstock officials. WIBX's Mike Rogers has the story.
Woodstock 99 gets the green light. There was some concern over whether the mega concert in Rome would come to fruition after Woodstock promoters racked up more than $1.5 million in fines for not complying with the mass gathering permit issued by Oneida County. Oneida County Executive Ralph Yenes says they've worked out a deal and will continue to negotiate the amount of the fines. Meanwhile, he says the concert will go on as planned.
Though he didn't attend Woodstock 1999, former radio personality and programmer Tom Starr notes that the festival did appear to be a much better planned event than its predecessor.
The concert production industry had grown into a very efficient and incredibly well-organized business, and as a consequence, they had just about every base covered. And the first and foremost would be making certain that there wasn't going to be gate crashing, making certain that they were going to come out of it with, you know, a reasonable chance of making money.
The gates are open now, and ticket holders are streaming in, walking, and being bussed in. Where once thundered, the eight engines of B-52 bombers will rock a crowd that may grow to over 250,000 people by tomorrow afternoon. That crowd will be surrounded by a painted wall of wood and canvas, 12 feet high, 3 miles long. It's called the Peace Wall, but this barrier is designed to do more than look pretty. It's to keep out people who don't have tickets.
Inside the Peace Wall, Woodstock's own private security force patrolled the grounds. Uniformed law enforcement officers were to remain outside the barrier.
I would say that security was not A1 quality. And maybe because they felt, you know, they had the whole place boarded up.
Steve Reynolds worked for MJI Broadcasting and was assigned to Woodstock 1999 to interview musicians and file reports on the festival.
We stayed in old barracks, actually. And that also was a kind of a weird thing. I was like, well, we're staying in old barracks. It's an old Air Force base, you know. I'm like, this is not the most comfortable vibe for a concert, and you know, and especially with all the pavement, and it was so hot. I mean, it was just, I remember viciously, viciously hot.
How hot is it here at Woodstock 99? Well, the crowd has been yelling for water. They don't want to drink it. They want it sprayed on them.
Phil Stern broadcasted his local radio talk show live from Woodstock on Friday afternoon.
We are joined right now
by WIBX's own Mike Rogers. Mike, how's it going this afternoon?
Well, it's going hot this afternoon.
God, is it hot this afternoon. I've never seen you looking that flushed, as a matter of fact.
Oh, it's mostly sunburn, I think, at this point. We've got some problems out at Woodstock right now.
Oh, we do?
Several hundred people at this point are being treated for heat exhaustion. It seems that the problem is there is such a demand for water that all of the water fountains all over the place no longer have water pressure.
Okay.
So people have no way of keeping cool. Medics are passing out bottled water right now, but not able to get to people quickly enough to keep them from literally dropping like flies.
There was water available on the grounds. It was very difficult to get to, if it was even available once you got to it.
Mike Coley is a Rome resident who attended Woodstock for all 3 days.
You were kind of stuck. If you needed water, it was the $4 bottles of water, which is kind of what the mantra of the whole weekend was, $4 bottles of water.
Steve Reynolds.
People were there the first day and were like, oh, it's really hot. Oh, they're charging, you know, Yankee Stadium prices for bottles of water that, you know, we could have gotten cheap if we could brought our own bottles of water in.
Despite the heat and what some would come to see as price gouging, on Friday afternoon, the festival seemed to be going flawlessly, as Woodstock Security Director Ken Donahue noted in a press conference.
Once again, 30 years later, history is repeating itself. There's nothing going on but peace and love and music inside.
It was a great day. Solid music, lots to do, lots of sights and sounds and things to participate in.
Sean Sauls.
There was still a positive vibe. You did start to hear the rumblings of complaints, costs of food, costs of water.
More than anything, I remember being hot and just thinking, man, we're walking on this tarmac. It's so hot.
Christy Clifford says that by Saturday afternoon, there was a noticeable deterioration in both the conditions of the site and the crowd's mood.
And walking around trying to find water and just seeing filth everywhere. It seemed like garbage cans were overflowing or tipped over, and porta potties were just surrounded by mud, I guess you could say. I don't know if it was mud or not, but it just was disgusting. And it didn't seem like everybody seemed, I don't want to say tense, but anxious maybe is a better word. Like you knew something, you felt something, but you didn't know what. I couldn't tell if it was the excitement in the air from the event itself or if it was people getting fed up. I did hear a lot of people complaining about prices.
I remember Saturday walking out, it was probably around lunchtime, and I remember
Steve Reynolds.
People just looking like they had been in a desert already, and this was only at noon. And you could kind of tell that people were just not happy.
How many people here ever woke up one morning and just decided it wasn't one of those days and you're going to break some shit? Well, this is one of them days, yo!
For me,
Sean Sauls.
The event on Saturday that I felt that really started to kick it off was Kid Rock set. And I remember standing there, I was about 100 yards back from the stage, and he just started to encourage everybody, just whatever you have, pick it up and start throwing it. Now, I've never been in a tornado, and I hope to never be, but I think that may have been the closest thing to a tornado that I hope I will ever experience. Just bottles and cans, glass, plastic, flying all over the place, dirt, mud. That kind of started to set the tone for the rest of that evening and the next day, where people were starting to really show their discontentment with the conditions, their wallets quickly dwindling.
Woodstock, can you hear me?
Saturday was a very, very testosterone-heavy, angry day of music. And I think that sent sort of an edge through the crowd that never really dissipated.
Hey guys, calm down a minute. Whoa, whoa. As you can see, if you look behind you, we have a bit of a problem.
The real trouble began sometime during the Red Hot Chili Peppers' closing set on Sunday evening.
There was this group that was giving out candles.
Mike Coley.
They were planning on doing this mass kind of like a peace thing where they wanted everybody to light a candle and pray for peace or something like that. As soon as these candles were starting to be passed out, people were lighting things on fire, trash or whatnot.
You have a bunch of upset people. They've been getting crankier throughout the weekend.
Sean Sauls.
And then you pretty much give them the ultimate thing to rebel with, which is fire. Everything that made them disgruntled and upset fans, well, how do we get rid of it? How do we erase the memory of, you know, how they screwed me over in that tent for $4 bottles of water? Burn it down.
Chili Peppers are going to come back. Calm down. We got 3 days through. We need... Calm down. We don't want anybody to get hurt. The delay tower is on fire, as you can see. It's not part of the show. It really is a problem. So the fire department's going to have to come in with a fire truck to put the fire out. If everybody can cooperate for the good firemen that are going to help, we'd appreciate it. You guys back there, all the way back near the fire, if you can hear me, back away. There's only a couple of 100,000 of you guys, but we need your help. So let's back away. Let's let the fire department do their job. Make sure nobody gets hurt. We'll be ready to go in just a little while.
The Red Hot Chili Peppers return to the stage, and in a pre-planned salute to the original Woodstock's closing act, Jimi Hendrix, performed a version of his song, Fire.
When things started to really get out of hand during the Chili Peppers set,
Steve Reynolds,
my coworker Sal, and I decided, you know what, hey, let's go out and see what's going on here, because, you know, this might turn into something, because you could see the fires are getting bigger, and you could actually smell it in the big press area.
According to most accounts, security forces had dwindled throughout the weekend, and on Sunday evening seemed to evaporate as the situation escalated.
And the Chili Peppers had ended, and people were still, like, breaking stuff and, you know, lighting on fire, and the bonfires kept growing. And it wasn't just a couple hundred people. It was a lot of people joining in on this.
You know, it was dark out at that point, but as I recall, looking up over the hangars, because you didn't have a direct line of sight between the west and east stage.
Sean Sauls.
You had to kind of go around the bend to see the hangars, but I remember starting to see this unnatural glow that wasn't the lights from the east stage. Something didn't look right there, and I just remember coming around that bend and just starting, and you're getting a full glimpse of the trailers that were on fire and all the separate bonfires that were set, the cars being flipped over, the concession tents being completely overrun.
It just had a sense of rage at the corporate man for ruining their rock show. I never was really able to put my finger upon exactly what it was, but it was a vibe where, living in New York, where you can walk into a situation and you automatically think, you know what, I should really keep walking as fast as I possibly can. Like, if you're walking on a block that's kind of shady, that's exactly the feeling I had when we were walking out there.
The chaotic finale to the Woodstock 99 concert resulted in 7 arrests and 5 injured. That's the word this morning from the head of the New York State Police.
In the aftermath, debates centered on just what had gone wrong. Was it negligent or non-existent security? The heat? Price gouging? Aggressive music? Was it evidence of some sort of failings on the part of this Woodstock generation? Historian Maurice Isserman.
Maybe they were disappointed. Maybe it didn't add up. Maybe they felt ripped off because it wasn't, as advertised in popular memory, a thoroughly transcendent experience.
The kids I met were nice kids.
As Phil Stern pointed out on his talk show, one thing was certain. The legacy of Woodstock 1999 would be far different from that of the original.
Friendly, thank you, please, good kids. So
well,
it couldn't have been everybody.
I'm sure most of them were, but, you know, there was someone rioting last night, and they weren't good kids saying please and thank you.
But,
unless it was, please pass me the accelerant and thank you for the firewood.
But you're talking about a few hours out of 72.
That's true, but you know what? It's those few hours that people are going to remember.
Lasting legacy of Woodstock.
Mike Coley.
I don't know. I think it says something about this country. It's what's in it for me, instead of let's all get together and have a good time.
You know, there's a chicken and egg thing. The culture, the music, the writing, everything else reflects to some extent the mood of the country and of a segment of people in the country, but the music also influences the mood.
Former radio personality and programmer Tom Starr.
And I think that when you look at the lineup from the 99 festival, there was a real change toward angst, anger, and aggression in the music. A lot of those bands had a much more aggressive crowd.
The original Woodstock involved a lot of serendipity. It could have turned out a lot worse. Governor Rockefeller was thinking of sending in the National Guard, and if he had not been persuaded otherwise, the organizers got him instead to send in medical teams and food. It could have degenerated into a riot. I mean, if all these armed soldiers in helmets suddenly showed up on the perimeter of Yasgur's farm, who knows how we would have remembered it.
I think that people look at the original festival as this big monumental event in the history of the United States.
Sean Sauls.
And I think that everybody just felt, you know, maybe this is going to be another major turning point in society. And, you know, as it turned out, by the end of Sunday night, everybody just obviously saw us in a different light.
Imagine Woodstock 99 ending on the second day, no riot, and there would have been incidents that were disturbing. But it wouldn't come down to us as this sort of great commentary on the 1990s or on the failings of young people in the 1990s or on even the music business in the 1990s. We'd have a different memory of it. So there's a lot of chance in this, and I wouldn't want to see this as an indictment of the later generation for not living up to the values of the earlier generation.
The 1999 Woodstock definitely ruined the brand, I think, for myself. I mean, I'm a 40, so I'm as old as the original Woodstock.
Steve Reynolds.
I think it ruined it maybe for a lot of people who, you know, were older, because all of a sudden you're like, well, there goes the peace and love, you know, ideals of the original. And I think that's why, as much as Michael Lang has tried, they've never been able to do another Woodstock-branded concert, because no one will want to take the risk of history repeating itself because it has the Woodstock name.
There's always been a problem with trying to reenact Woodstock, because you'll never get back there. There'll never be an event again under that name that has such a dramatic impact or creates such a durable myth. And it'd be better, I think, if other future events were organized that may be like Woodstock, but they had a different name and a different logo and a different set of expectations, and you don't bring in, you know, a few of the old acts to make it feel as if, you know, it's just a continuation of the original. Every generation should create its own mythology and have its own transcendent experience.
And if it had been something that went off flawlessly and everybody had enough space and enough food and enough water, and there wasn't a sea of mud and there weren't overflowing toilets, then it would have been probably a pretty good event. But a lot of those other things and the way in which people compensated for them is what made Woodstock Woodstock. And I don't think that it's likely to be replicated on that kind of scale for quite some time, if ever. We are
stars. Historical Memory and the Woodstock Legacy was written, narrated, and produced by Jeff Storm. Special thanks to Maurice Isserman, Tom Starr, Sean Sauls, Steve Reynolds, Christy Clifford, Mike Coley, Rick Lewis, Phil Stern, and Aaron Covey.